The point of that was to turn it around so people could see it. But anyway, so Craig has signed this one, and we're going to give it away at the end along with a book. So those of you who bought a book should have a number in your book, and that's what we use. My husband says one day I'll go to jail for having an illegal lottery here, but too damn bad, right? Right. Anyway, Craig has signed that, and I think it's really exciting. So many thanks for coming out to Barbieheimer Part 2. You're the Heimer part because Barbie was here earlier. I love it. Yeah, I mean, a double matinee is a really interesting idea, I think. But thank you for spending part of Labor Day with us, and welcome to Craig. This is his national book launch. Today is the day. Yay! Really exciting stuff. You know what? You need a microphone, or nobody's going to be able to do that, right? You've got it on?
Test there. One, two.
There yep. we go.
All right.
I'm doing a lot of interviews. Like, and everybody keeps asking, like, what's it like? You know, 20, 19, 20 books? Like, really? Like, and I'm like, I don't know. You know, it just, because it all seems like one book to me. It's all stories that are all kind of intertwined and interlaced with each other like that. And so I don't even look at them as, like, you know, individual books in many ways. Like, that they're all just one.
Well, the Longmire family story is a sort of continuing saga.
It is.
In this book, we're going to go back and plumb the past with Walt's grandfather, who was also a sheriff. So is the sheriff a hereditary position
no,
in Walt's
grandfather
County?
Was not a sheriff.
He wasn't.
No. That's a couple of times people have said that. Like, and he's not the sheriff in the book. What we discover is that he was like one of the major backers for Lucian Conley when Lucian Conley became sheriff. And so I think a lot of people mistook that, like, and thought that he was a sheriff, but no, he wasn't.
You mean a careless reading like mine?
Well, you know, hey, like, you read a lot, you know, and retaining all that gets difficult after a while. Like, but the other thing is they discover that he owned the bank of Durant, you know, that he was one of the ranchers that formed, like, a consortium in the 1930s, like, when the bank was going to go under. And so these big ranchers all got together, which is not an unusual occurrence in Wyoming at that period in time. They had a lot of money, like, and so they could, like, you know, take over the debt that the bank had, make it solvent again. And so what we discover is that Walt's grandfather was actually the chief of the director of the board, you know, for the Bank of Durant, which put him in, you know, into that financial kind of area like that, which is what the book is a lot about.
Right. Okay. So what book number is this?
This is book number 19. Not including the two novellas, Spirit of Steamboat and Highwayman. And the collection of short stories, Wait for Signs. Like that, so.
So we're going to have a bigger party next year when it comes to book 20 with probably cake. Maybe
we're approaching
rum cake.
A silver anniversary.
Do any of you
there,
remember
right?
Kathy's rum cake? Do any of you have lived here a long time? Remember Kathy's rum cake? I think she might have gone out of business, but when she was nearby, we had several interesting parties with Kathy's rum cake, which was great because, you know, you got to get drunk and sugar and all that good stuff all at the same time. It was wonderful. Right.
A lot of serious wild, loose good limb stuff. Dancing, like
right.
It sounds like.
So when you're writing about the same character, and he is an action character now, you put him through some really difficult things. Do we assume, because remember when he met, well, you remember, of course you wrote it, but do you all remember?
Not necessarily.
You all remember.
You guys are always writing me and going, like, in that seventh book, when Walt does this, that, and the other thing, and this happens, is that, just, and I'm like, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
So he went to Mexico, remember?
Oh, yeah.
He got beat up.
That one was
all
brutal.
Right.
That
and then
was brutal.
Last year's book, he was in Montana, and a lot of interesting things happened. So my question is, do we all assume that he's had a year of healing up, or
oh, no.
How do you deal with the events of last year's book when this book opens?
Well, I mean, the way I write the books, you guys know this, like I'd call it the Vivaldi is what I call it, like that, because, you know, whenever I would read books, you know, they would have the character, you know, I guess it was Robert Parker, I guess I got it most annoyed with, because he would, like, you know, have like a year or two go by and then the new book would, you know, I was always like, I was really love those characters. And I was always like, well, what happened in that year or two? Come on, you know? And so I wanted a little bit, you know, closer, you know, sort of, quality to the books. Like, and then I remember when I first started out, Tony Hillerman, like I was talking to Tony one time at dinner. And he said, well, you know, because he was like working on his like 18th book or something, probably where I am now, back when I first started like that. And And he said, I said to him, like, how do you do this? Because I hadn't written a second book. Like, and he said, well, you got to play them up, like, you know, at the risk of sounding like a bad sports analogy, you got to play them up one at a time. Like, and he said, the other thing is, he says, if you can find some kind of a format or something to work with, that'll work really, really well, too. And so I thought about it, and I thought, okay, well, what's the one thing that has more of an effect on us as Westerners than anything else? The weather, right? And so I thought, okay, well, what if you did the four seasons? Wouldn't that be interesting? Like, because, you know, Wyoming in January is nothing like Wyoming in July. Like that, and, you know, and so I thought they'll give me completely different environs for each book. Like that. The other thing it did was it unintentionally slowed Walt's aging process dramatically. Because as you guys know, like next book will be book number 20, right? Walt will only be 5 years older than when we first met him. And people have asked me, they say, well, what do you do about technology? And I'm like, it's in Wyoming. We don't have technology. Like, for gosh sake, I was on a panel in France, like, and there were, you know, three other French writers, like, and they were all talking about, oh, in my book, you just sit in the 1960s, so there are no cell phones, you know. And then the next one was like, oh, well, my book is set, you know, in the 80s, like, so there are no, you know, there are no computers, so I don't have to deal with all that. And I'm looking at all of them, and I'm like, you guys could just come to Wyoming, because we don't have any of that shit practically, like, and so, because. It's true, like that. I mean, you know, unless you're going to take selfies, you know, with the, you know, with a cell phone of you getting run over by a buffalo or something like that. There, if there's no conductivity, they don't have any, you know, any towers or anything like that. So they're no use, like that. So for me, that's kind of handy to not have that technology. And if you guys read, let's see, what was it? It was Land of Wolves. If you read Land of Wolves, you saw where Walt accidentally requisitioned a computer for himself. And Ruby tried to teach him how to use it through the whole book. And finally, at the end, she just took it away from him and said, forget it. It's not going to work. Like, you know, never mind. But that's, you know, kind of the way it is. Like, and so Walt, you know, he's, like I said, only 5 years older than when we first meet him at the Cold Dish. And then the other aspect of it, of course, is that, you know, that there's a continuity to it. I mean, each book is only at the most about 4 months later than the previous book. And so if Walt gets beat up, you know, or hurt in some fashion, well, then it's going to continue on in the next book, which is only realistic, you know, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if he gets hurt or does damage to himself like that, he's going to have to contend with that. Like, and I think it might have even been Land of Wolves where he had to go in for his insurance checkup for the county. And poor Isaac Bloomfield is going through all the things that have happened to him in the last 5 years, you know, and he's like, well, you're doing remarkably well for a man your age, like with this much damage to yourself. Like, and so, yeah, for me, that's kind of an important aspect of the books, like that he continued to be hurt like that. And it does happen.
I asked this question because at dinner last night, Craig was recounting how while cutting up umpteen cords of firewood with a chainsaw, he very nearly cut his foot off. So what would you have done? I mean, seriously.
I could have sat at the table, at the desk a lot longer, like that, not had to go out and do work if I had lost a foot. You know, I think that would be like, you know, kind of a blessing, I think, as a writer like that. But I got these big Husqvarna chainsaws, and I did 18 cords blocking and splitting in 1 week. And I also dropped 18 pounds in that 1 week. Like, and so, you know, that
would have been more if you'd cut off your foot.
I know. I got a couple more, like another five. Man, that's a size 12D. That would have been more than 5 pounds, I think. Like,
so you had to order new boots.
Well, yeah. Like, it's funny, like, because you work like that, you know, and any of you, you know, a lot of you have done that kind of work like that. But if you work like that, you know, you're running like either heavy machinery or a chainsaw, you know, with skip tooth. I mean, it'll go through anything pretty quick. And so I'm going to sound like a sissy saying this, like that, but it was like 92 degrees. So for us, that's hot. Like, you know, when you're out there working like that for about 5 or 6 hours, it gets really hot. Like, and so when you start stumbling, that's when you know you need to stop like that, because you're going to make a mistake and something's going to happen. And so I just about gotten to that point, and I'd lowered the chainsaw down like this, and I heard this, and I was like, that was my foot. And, you know, they have that moment where you don't want to look, you know, where you're like, you don't even want to see it like that, because, you know, it's going to be something horrible. And so I remember like moving my toes and going, nah, they all feel like they're there, you know. And then I looked down, and what had happened was it had hit a glancing blow off the side of the boot, and it just ripped the leather all the way down one side like that. But it didn't get me. It didn't even get my sock like that. And so I thought I kind of got away with something at that
point. Poor excuse for wanting to buy a new pair of boots, right? Now,
I did go out and buy a pair of, like, what was it, steel-toed logger boots the next day. I was like, I'm going to at least keep my toes as long as I can. Like, so
I'm going to embarrass this lovely lady over here in the front row right in front of Craig because she is wearing the coolest boots. I am struck with boot envy.
Those
what
are
do you
very
think?
Nice.
Aren't they gorgeous?
And they partially match my book, which I really appreciate. So
that's true.
That's the turquoise part. Judy really loves the cover on this. My wife, Judy, is over here, in case some of you don't know. She really loves this cover, but I think the reason is because it looks like Indian, you know, jewelry, because it's got the coral and the turquoise, you know, and all of that. You know, whenever I'm looking at the covers of the books, I always pick things up like at later that they were probably, you know, pretty obvious with. But the one thing I noticed in this one is that there are two Walts when he's looking in the water here. One is the light colored Walt and one is the dark colored Walt here, kind of emphasizing that kind of like darker aspect of Walt's nature in this particular book. I don't want to go into too much detail. I don't know.
No, we don't
know how much you want to go into detail.
I don't care. I said we were going to digress because we can't really talk about the books. So one thing I will point out to you, though, and this is sort of a thing about publishing, when a first novel comes out, nobody knows who the author is, right? So the publishers give the title this enormous, you know, typeface, and then underneath it in small type, it will say, Craig Johnson, notice by now. especially on the spine of the book, right? So,
and I used to say that because I was always like, as soon as the author's name becomes bigger than the title, they're crap. And so, you know, and I was like, so here I am,
I hope that won't be true. But, you know, it's interesting that it reflects on all of you because, like with I mentioned earlier, you know, where the crawdads sing, when people wanted to buy it, nobody knew who D. Owens was, so they would say, you know, I want to order a copy of The Crawdads Sing. Now, when Craig comes, all we get is an order that says, I want the new Craig Johnson. Nobody cares what the title is, you know, whatever it all is. And, you know, I find that really interesting, and I've often thought I should have a graph where I could plot at that moment when it tilts from the title to the author.
To the author, yeah.
Yeah.
And this one's title, it changed. Like at the original title for the book was, I'll get your guys' opinion, see what you think. The original title was Proud Flesh, is what it was. And for those of you who've done equestrian work, or veterinarian work, you know what proud flesh is. What it is like whenever a horse, gets hurt, like on a leg wound or something like that, you know, well, that's a herding animal. And so the way it survives, you know, as an ungulate, is to be able to get away from predators. And so they heal up very, very fast. The trick is that they heal up so fast, that a lot of the vascular material and nerve material doesn't fill in. It's just granular flesh is what it is, called proud flesh. And it enables the animal to be able to get back up on its feet and survive like that. But what they have to do is, you know, to get it properly fixed, you have to go back in and carve out the proud flesh, so that the regular flesh can grow back in slowly but surely, you know, so that the animal can be safe, and capable of, having vascular material and all of that. And so they call it proud flesh. Well, there was an old ranch, an old sheriff that I was talking to from out of Montana, and he was talking about an investigation, and he says, well, sometimes, yeah, you know, you'll run into a situation, you know, a proud flesh kind of situation, and I was like, what's that? And he goes, well, that's when you're going into an investigation with a preconceived idea of what it is that happened and who did it. And he says, and then you start doing the investigation, you discover you were wrong. And he says, then you got to take all that you put into that investigation back out so that you can start that investigation and start all over again. And I was like, oh. Proud Flesh. All right. That's the title of this book. Then Viking Penguin came back and said, it sounds like a porno. Judy agreed with him, so I had to give that one up. There wasn't any way I could do that one like that. So
could have been a bestseller in the veterinary community. So you might wonder why it's called The Longmire Defense, and we'll explain that. So we can at least talk about what I like to call the instigating incident. In other words, how does this story take off?
Well, it's...
And it takes off in part. Let me come back. Walt is still recovering from the events that happened to him in Montana. So he's not... he's not totally 100% back.
No, no. Like it, and what happens is like this book kind of harkens back, you know, to a number of different episodes that I've referred to during the series of the books, in that Walt does not have a good relation, or did not have a good relationship with his grandfather. I mean, there's obviously something there. These little glimpses that we get, we don't get the whole story, but we know they did not get along. Like, and so it's kind of a rough road to hoe between the two of them. Like, and the only place that they ever really could, you know, come to terms with each other, the only place that they could ever tolerate each other, was on the chessboard. Because Walt's grandfather was the one that taught him how to play chess. Like, and so in that, I think what the old man was trying to do was trying to train his grandson how to use his mind, how to be like 1, 2, 3, maybe 4, 5 steps ahead of whoever it is you're up against at that point in time. And for an investigator, that's really a valuable trait to have. Like, and so those chickens kind of come home to roost with Walt, because he does have that ability to kind of like move ahead and see ahead of what everybody else is doing like that. And so one of the moves that they use like that against each other was this thing called the Longmire defense, which was a particularly ruthless move to save yourself towards the end of a game. And it's interesting like that, because there's a guy who's a chess expert later on in the books like that, you know, and Walt and he are discussing this thing called the Longmire defense. And he's like, you know, your grandfather came up with that, you know, approximately 20 years before it was ever used in professional chess. And Walt's like, yes. Like, and he goes, he actually used that against you when you were 6 years old. And he's like, yeah, he did. Like, which kind of explains, I think, the relationship a little bit, because I think what it is, it's like, you know, the term we always use, like, you know, in ranching communities, is two bulls in a paddock. You know, they were too much alike. They were too much alike, and they were never going to get along. They're just, you know, they could find ways, you know, to deal with each other, but they were never going to completely accept each other, you know, and so it kind of makes for like an unusual situation for Walt and his grandfather. And so what happens in the plot of the book is that Walt's on a usual, you know, search and rescue like that, you know, and I like doing that. I like Walt dealing with a lot of the things the sheriffs deal with while he's dealing, you know, with the big case, you know, because it makes it more realistic, I think. And so he's up on the mountain with this search and rescue like that, and they're trying to find this woman who's gotten away from her car. And Walt, you know, finds her, because he comes to the idea that, you know, people don't get lost going uphill. They generally get lost going downhill. And he finds this woman like that. And then, you know, they're out in the middle of nowhere and his radio doesn't work. And of course, you know, he doesn't have a cell phone. So he has to borrow her cell phone like that. And then he sees a rock outcropping that he goes up on, and he gets up on the rock outcropping and calls ahead and tells search and rescue and calls Vic and says, here, we're coming out on this trailhead. You know, we'll meet you there. I found her. Everything's fine like that. And so he closes up the phone like that. And he looks around and he recognizes this rock outcropping. He realizes that he's been here before. And what it is he remembers his father telling him a story about it when he was a kid. And what his father says to him is, did I ever tell you about the first time I ever saw a man die? And Walt says, no. And so he tells him the entire story. And what happened was, is the state accountant, a fellow by the name of Bill Sutherland, back in 1948, comes back from World War II, having fought in the Battle of the Bulge, like in the Ardennes, and he gets back, and he calls up, you know, Walt's grandfather and says, hey, I want to come and do an elk hunt, you know, up on your camp. Would that be okay? And so they were like, sure, come on ahead. And so he comes up and they go on this hunt, and he's shot. And they're never quite sure if he was shot on purpose or if he was shot on accident. But they do know that he was shot with, which was at that time, a very experimental kind of weapon, a 300 H&H Magnum is what it is. Like that. And in the late 1940s, that was a very custom kind of weapon like that nobody had, and certainly a caliber that nobody had. Like it. And so they never find the weapon. They can't find the weapon. Nobody had, you know, they can't find it anywhere. Nobody was hunting with that weapon up on the mountain. They don't know who it belonged to. And so with Walt sitting there thinking about all these things, like, and he's standing there looking around, and you know, the hillside and the rocks and all this, like, and he hears the dog digging in the rocks down below the outcropping, and yells at the dog and says, get out of there before a marmot comes out and, you know, bites your nose off, for goodness sake. About that time, dog raises his head up, and he's got a leather strap hanging out of his mouth. It could be a piece of horse tack, or it could be a rifle sling. And Walt climbs down, reaches down into the rocks, and pulls out a Weatherby H&H 300 Magnum, circa 1948. And I like to think of Walt as being the most ecumenical of investigators. He's a firm believer in innocent until proven guilty, fair-minded, until he discovers that this rifle belonged to Lloyd Longmire, his grandfather. And that sets us off on a completely different kind of investigation.
It does. And the Longmire defense is a double entendre title in part, is it not? Right. So, I mean, part of this, I mean, the story, you like going back into the past. I mean, that's one of the things that's always been a hallmark of your book, is wherever we are in the present, which I might say, well, if he served in Vietnam, where are we, like 1978 or something?
I don't know.
I don't care. Just have to keep it in
every
mind.
Once in a while, somebody get real mathematical with me, you know, and write me the, you know, he says, well, if Walt was this, and this was that, and this was here, and he was there, and this is that, and then Walt would be this age. And I'm like, maybe. Maybe not. I don't care. You know, what do you want me to do? Kill him? What do you want? Like that, you know? I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, I really like him. He's a great guy. I'm not going to kill him off like that. So, you know, we're still going to have to, like, pound it out there. But, no, you're absolutely right in the sense that, you know, I really enjoy circling back around. I mean, I love leaving myself bookmarks in the books for something that I want to write about later. And then I'll hear that and I'll be like, oh, yeah, that's that story about that I wanted to do. And I'll be honest with you, the plot, you know, for this particular book, especially the historical aspect of the plot. How many of you guys remember Elmer Keith? How many of you remember Elmer Keith, the writer? Not too many. Like, wow. He was a fantastic outdoorsman writer in like, you know, gosh, I guess like the 30s and 40s and even into the 50s and 60s. And he was a big game hunter, an outfitter. And he was also a writer, and he wrote this book called Hell, I Was There, and it was kind of his autobiographical book, and I remember that book being on my father's shelf in his den, and I remember reading, because I read every book that was in our house, and so it was about, and in that book, there's a story about this fellow who was the state accountant for the state of Montana, and he doesn't mention names, but it happened right after World War I. It was like 1918 or 1919, I think it was. And what happened was the state accountant for the state of Montana, you know, went to war like that and came back, and you know, went off on this elk hunt like that, you know. And these two other guys from the Treasury Department from the state of Montana talked these guys into letting them go hunting too, and he was shot and killed. And he doesn't mention, you know, any of the details or anything like that, but I'm firmly of the belief that what happened was these two guys were doing things they shouldn't have been doing while this guy was off to war, and when he came back, he found out what it was that they were up to like that. And so I can't take complete, you know, use of the plot line for this particular book like that. And but it's, you know, it was a very, very interesting story that haunted me for years and years. And so I thought, okay, this is definitely something I'm going to have to write about.
Well, you know, but it's not surprising that during a period of war or whatever, when people went away from their jobs and other people were left to flounder or misbehave or whatever it was, there'd be a lot of cleanup.
Oh, yeah. And so then it also was like the situation between Walt and his grandfather, because we knew a little bit about his grandfather, but not a whole lot about his grandfather like that. And so we learned a lot more about him in this particular book, like a lot of things that Walt himself didn't know. Because when he starts this investigation, he starts, you know, digging in places that he had never dug before and asking people questions that he had never asked those questions before. And so it was kind of interesting to see how much of that information came out and how much more we learn about Lloyd Longmire, whether by the time you get to the end of the book, you either respect Lloyd Longmire or suspect Lloyd Longmire. We'll see. I'm going to leave that to you guys.
So what about the Longmire property ranch, whatever you want to call it? I don't remember you're talking about that very much.
Yeah, he actually goes and visits it in Dark Horse. Like that, it's right. one of the places that he goes. Like it, and in many ways, that's almost like the way that he's punishing the ghost of his grandfather, because his grandfather built this incredible ranch, and the ranch does exist. It's the XL Bar, is what it is, up on right on the Wyoming Montana border. And if you ever get a chance, you get home, just look up the XL Bar Ranch. Like it's absolutely spectacular, and it's got like these sandstone blocks it was built from that are like 18 inches thick, and it's just a spectacular spot right there, you know, by the river and everything. And but he's kind of like ignored it completely. He won't go take care of it. He doesn't, you know, invest any money in it, trying to take care of it. He doesn't go work on it or anything. He's almost like he's punishing his grandfather for their relationship by just allowing it to decay. And he kind of comes to some terms with that, too, later on in the book, too. So,
Right. No, I mean, I had a little trouble with that. You know, I thought that that wasn't super responsible of Walt to have this gorgeous property. And
absolutely,
there it was. And, you know, I mean, if you actually were writing it in the context of today, when people are moving into Wyoming and Montana, you know, grabbing great big pieces of land and all the rest of it. I mean, look how we got hit in Scottsdale with all kinds of people who came here during COVID, many of whom after this summer probably are relocating. But anyway.
That's what I always tell anybody once we move to Wyoming. I'm like, you should come out in January, you know, because they do. They come in July, you know, or June like that, you know, and it's all green and beautiful and warm and all that. And they look up and see the mountains, you know, see the snow up there. And I'm like, there's a lot more of that, you know, in the wintertime, just so you know.
A lot more of that coming. How many of you lost a saguaro or had a saguaro drop a limb? Did any of you? Well, we did. We have a beautiful saguaro. I mean, it lights up our neighborhood at Christmas. It took three men and a lift truck to put the Christmas lights around the saguaro last Christmas. We weren't sure how our neighbors in the HOA were going to react to that, but better to ask forgiveness than permission. So we did it anyway. And then it turned out at the HOA meeting in the whenever it was last summer, they were starting or spring. They were mulling over whether they could contribute or pay for the cactus to be lit up again. We said, no, it's all fine. It's all covered. And then it dropped this, you know, you'll see it tonight when we have dinner. It dropped this gorgeous limb, just great. You know, weighs 700 pounds. I was really glad I wasn't under it because saguaro, you know, they take in all that water. But all over town, if you look around, you will see saguaro that have either totally collapsed or, and I thought to myself, so if a cactus can't survive at 190, what's for us here? And also, I never even thought about watering a cactus, but now it turns out that you really need to water your saguaro, just, you know, adding local landscape here. But, you know, Wyoming, even though it has these wild climate swings, does it recover enough, you know, winter to summer? You get water in the winter and sun, and also that you don't have a crisis like the saguaro crisis?
We had well, it was a cold winter, but it was also a deeply snowy winter this year. And then we had a very wet spring, very wet, going all the way through summer, all the way through into August. We were having rainstorms like at pretty much, you know, like
so
every
jealous.
Afternoon for about 40 minutes. Like it. And so it actually was a pretty banner year actually for yeah. us. Like it. And we're hoping for a few more like that. It's kind of nice.
Around here has been the summer without rain, right?
Mm.
Back in 1815, when a volcano went off in somewhere in Indonesia, it was known as the year without a summer. Because the volcanic ash went up, you know, and blanked everything and all. And now I feel like, as I said, this was the summer without rain. Who knows where it's all going? Maybe more people will move to Wyoming, which I understand has the lowest population density despite its square miles. Maybe it's time to move north. No. Ah, okay. Right, that's right. Anyway, so the property comes into play, and I thought it was really interesting to spend some time there. Walt meets somebody from his past. There are a lot of things going on in the story that, you know, reach back into the past in this book.
Oh, yeah, and some major changes, you know, some major changes in the books, too, like that. I mean, this is one of the, for me, a hallmark of, like, you know, a good series is that things change, that the characters develop. You know, it's not just the same thing happening, you know, episode after episode after episode like that. And, you know, the characters don't ever go anywhere. Nothing ever changes in their lives or anything like that. And for me, you know, I guess I look at that and I think to myself, that's not like life. You know, we all have to adapt and change as our lives go on like that. And so there are some big things that happen in this particular book, like along the way. I don't want to give any of them away.
No,
but
we can't do that. But I was happy to see Cesar Baturia come back. Now, I practiced years to say that. It's a Basque name. Many of you probably read it and pass right over saying it in your head because it's so hard. But he's a neat character, and he has a role in this book, which I really liked.
Yeah. Yeah, no, like, and it's, you know, for me, that's always the fun part of it. It's almost like a chess game in many ways like that, because, you know, you move out different pieces like that for whatever it is that you need to do with the story. Like, and so there's an ensemble of characters, but, you know, there's always going to be not the same amount of the same characters, you know, in every book, because then the books would become extraordinarily formulaic. So for me, it's really kind of important to think to myself, okay, who are the important characters in this book and who needs to be in this book to help me to write the book?
And so, yeah, he definitely was one of the ones that had to make a good, strong comeback.
So is Henry in this book?
Henry's in this book like that. He's not as heavy as a lot of times, right, like that, because it's not a native book. Okay, and so there's not a lot of aspects of the native culture in that. Like that. And that's when I really have to utilize Henry to his fullest extent. But, you know, but he's there. He's there, you know, kind of like coaching Walt along, like that, as Walt has some difficult decisions in his life to make.
Okay, he does, right. But also, this time, Walt actually has to go down to Cheyenne.
He does.
And his daughter and granddaughter make bigger roles in this book than they might in some other cases, right?
He does.
Because she's involved. She's what is her role again?
She is an assistant attorney general, like that is what she is. Like that.
Right.
And so, and now there's talk, we've discovered, well, I don't want to give that away, though. Sorry.
Not doing that, but
thought about it, but didn't change my mind,
right.
So I'm sorry.
But you know, Walt does travel out of Absaroka County from time to time, and in this case, you know, he's going south towards Cheyenne rather
he
than
does. He
north
does.
Into Montana.
That's kind of the fun of it, like that. I mean, you know, whenever you know you've got a character like that, you know, the fun part is like to have them branch out, you know, and go in some different places like that. But you know, the big thing, of course, is that Walt's kind of going back in time, like that, to kind of figure out what happened, you know, at this one instance back in 1948. And the difficulty of that kind of a book, you know, is that you run the risk of it becoming like a research book, you know, and then all you've got is the primary character. All they're doing is just being a librarian and doing the research to find this stuff out. Well, that doesn't place them in a great deal of peril. And so, you know, you have to have some kind of a modern day connection for the character that imperils them or puts them in action, like as far as that type of thing is concerned. And so in this one, like that, it turns out to be the, you know, the primary wealth fund, mineral wealth fund for the state of Wyoming, which is like a huge fund that provides a great deal of money, you know, to the state of Wyoming. I'm sure Arizona's got one too. But a lot of the western states, what they found was that they could prop up their, you know, their finances like that by having these mineral funds like that that would bring in not millions with an M, but billions with a B, to help provide a certain percentage of, you know, the state per capita. And so Wyoming, it was interesting because it's always fun to me to, like, you know, find out interesting things. I found out that in 1968, the state of Wyoming had $80 in the bank. I'm not kidding. They had $80.14 in the bank. Okay, and they realized, we got to do something different. And so what they did was, is that, I think it was Nevada and Alaska were some of the first ones to institute that primary, you know, mineral wealth fund. And so what they did was, is like, you know, every time that, like, you know, goods are taken, you know, materials are taken out of the state gets a certain percentage of that funding. And so it's kind of fun like that, because there's a part in the book, you know, where Walt's trying to explain, you know, the primary, you know, mineral wealth fund to Ruby, who keeps referring to it as the MNLOP or whatever it is that you keep talking about. But Walt's trying to explain it to her, and she's looking at him, and she's like, what do you know about this? You can't even balance your checkbook. Okay. And so, you know, it's not a really strong, like, in the finance aspect, you know, but you do learn a little bit about that, which I didn't know. I didn't know a lot of the information that was involved with that. And so what happens, of course, is Walt not only stumbles into this information, but also stumbles into another wealth fund like that, that might be kind of a parasitic wealth fund that's been siphoning off money from the state of Wyoming since 1948. And once again, we're not talking about millions with an M, we're talking about billions with a B. And so it kind of puts Walt, you know, right in the target, like out of some individuals who do not want this information to get out. And I have to admit that, like, there's a lot of individuals in this book that have a lot of military training, you know, and they're like Delta and SEALs and all these different things. And as they go through the book and they kind of underestimate Walt, they keep asking him, what were you in the military? What were you? And all Walt says is, just a Marine. And they make the mistake of underestimating Walt is what they do, like, which Walt loves more than anything else in the world.
His size protects him to some part. I mean, he's a really big guy, you know, and I think that that makes a big difference. But the central question for Walt, obviously, in this book is, was his grandfather a killer? Because when he finds the rifle, then, and because he and his grandfather have such bad history, Walt is much more inclined to think that his grandfather was guilty all the way through the book. And so you have to read it to the end to discover whether Walt was right or not. I like that, you know, that instead of leaping up to say, no, he was my grandfather, he has to be innocent, you know, go. He is going, oh, it was my grandfather. He probably did it, you know, and then we have to go from there.
Well, the stories that you hear about this guy like that, I mean, you know, there's the bank president like that is talking to Walt like that, and he says, oh, well, I remember like at the previous bank president telling me about your, you know, your grandfather taking his boots off and pounding them on the desk to get everybody to come to order whenever they would have a meeting or something. He says, and I remember also there was a story that in 1932, two guys broke into the bank to try and rob it, like that they came walking in the lobby with their guns and your grandfather shot them both dead. So it's like, it's not untoward that this man was perfectly capable of doing what it is that Walt suspects that he did. And he's got some hard edges to him too, like that, which was kind of, I think, you know, interesting because, I mean, whenever there's a scene like between Walt and Lucian, there's some really good scenes with Lucian like that, where Walt gets the real information, you know, about his grandfather from Lucian. And, you know, it was a different time period, you know, a different time period like that, you know, and hard times make for hard people like that. And so some of the individuals that were involved in this period in time, they had some hard bark on them.
So thinking about television, what was it, 1924 Yellowstone, what's the first one, 18? Thank you. All right. So you could almost do that with Longmire now. If you really go back into the history of the grandfather, you could have something like, well, and I mention that because we're sort of stuck on Longmire, but what if in fact we could start with Longmire, you know, we could do his grandfather, never mind about where we are. So where are we with television?
Well, I mean, we're still, our little cowboy and Indian show that stopped production here about 6 years ago is still one of the top 10 to 20 shows on Netflix every other week. Okay, and so that's kind of reassuring, like that, you know, because I like to think that, like, one of the things that the show reaffirms is that, you know, that good people, you know, do the right thing. Like that. And so for me, you know, that's kind of a key element to the show. People ask me, they say, well, why does it still continue to have an audience? Why does it still garner an audience? And I'm like, well, it's not embarrassing. That's one thing. Some people have asked me about some other shows like that and said, well, what do you think about that? And I'm like, I'm kind of embarrassed by them. And they say, well, what do you mean? Like that. And I said, I don't want people around the world to think that we behave that way, for goodness sake. Like that. I think of Walt as being a really good, he's emblematic of like who I think we are, like that we're stand-up people, like that we do the right thing, you know, that we're tough enough, like to take the hard times, like it. And I just think that, to me, that's a lot more than a lot of the salacious stuff that you see nowadays. Like, it's kind of important to me, I have to admit.
Draw a parallel with Star Trek. I mean, who knew that when it, what was it like, only three seasons or something for Star Trek, and you know, it's still going strong with infinite edit. But that's what made me think of it, because there are prequels and sequels. Oh, God, yeah. And also, maybe if they can't get past, why, what is going on? Is that Warner is making so much money and the other, they don't have any incentive to do a new show?
You know, there's nothing corporations like better than doing nothing and making money. they really enjoy that. Like, and the fact that like this show that they made for six seasons, like at both Netflix and Warner, like that, it's just continuing on and garnering an audience. And I mean, every day I get emails from people that are like, I've been watching your TV show. Now I've started reading your books. Like, I just found the TV show, you know, here a couple months ago or last week or something. And so, it's kind of, you know, fun to see that happening, I have to admit, like that. But yeah, you know, I mean, until, you know, they finally come to, because I think seriously, like, I think what Netflix was thinking was, okay, we've got this little cowboy Indian show, it's a good little show like that, but we'll just, you know, we'll run it for a year or two like that, and then it'll lose its audience and we'll cancel it and get rid of it. Well, that was 6 years ago. And we're still one of the top 10 to 20 shows every other week. Like, and so it's kind of hard for them to get rid of it. And I think that there's probably a sweetheart deal between Warner Brothers and Netflix, because Netflix, you know, produced, you know, the last, at least put up the finances like that for the last three seasons. Like, and so, you know, I don't think that they're going to do anything. I mean, I don't know if it's going to take, you know, for the ratings to go down or for somebody to finally wake up, you know, over there at Warner Brothers, where they keep producing all these horrible superhero movies that tank them to the tune of, like, you know, I don't know, $250 million or something like this. My gosh, like, you know, 5 minutes of one of those movies was an entire season of Longmire, for goodness sake. Like, and so we'll see what happens. You know, I mean, they'll either go broke or they'll figure it out, or else they'll sell it to somebody, which is what A&E wanted. And a lot of you may not know, like, but A&E wanted the show. They wanted to buy it. And when Warner Brothers wouldn't sell it, that's why they canceled it, because it was the highest rated scripted drama they ever had. And so then Netflix had it for 3 years. And what happened? Netflix wanted to buy it. Warner Brothers wouldn't sell it to them. So they stopped it after doing three seasons, which is why it stopped after six seasons. We never really lost our audience. The thing was, is like, you know, that, you know, all of these, you know, broadcasting corporations, they wanted to own the show and produce it themselves, and Warner Brothers wouldn't give it up. So
it's almost as confusing as publishing, honestly. But my that's why I'm
Can I tell a really inappropriate Warner Brothers story right now?
Absolutely.
Okay, so there was this big party that was happening in Beverly Hills, and this was like back, you know, like in the 30s, like in 20s or 30s, like, yeah, the 30s, like at late 30s, I guess. And they were this guy that was having this big party, you know, was walking by the balcony of his home, like at where he was having this big party with all these tons of people and all this kind of stuff. And he looked out on the balcony, and there was Lionel Barrymore peeing off of his balcony. And he goes over, like, and he says, "Lionel, we have indoor plumbing. You can, you know, go to the bathroom in the house, like, if you want to." And he goes, "No, I'm trying to see if I can hit Warner Brothers from here." So every once in a while, I feel the same way. Look at that.
Well, that's why I was mentioning Walt's grandfather. You could have a totally new cast,
absolutely,
you know, and it would be, because I think the structure of the 1880-1924 Helen Mirren, how does she do it? I mean, she still looks so great, you know? I mean, she's got to be almost as old as I am or possibly older. And, you know, I just find it amazing. But that, but then, and then Yellowstone and Kevin Costner made a comeback and all that other good stuff. So maybe you could do that.
Yeah, who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, we'll see. So what's coming up next for Walt? Because I know, because Craig told me, you'll be happy to know that he turned in the draft of the next book before he came here. Yay!
Yeah. It's the first time I've ever finished next year's book by the time I went on tour. This was like fast. This one went really, really fast. I think it's because it's been in the back of my head for a really long time, and I've been working on it, working on it, working on it. What happens is that the majority of this book takes place in 1963. And what happens is Walt and Henry graduate from college and lose their deferment and get their draft notices. And so what happens is, you know, of course, Henry comes down from Berkeley, like at Walt's at USC. And so they head out on this road trip on Route 66 because Henry has to report to Fort Polk in Louisiana and Walt has to report to Parris Island in South Carolina. So they have to go all the way across the United States on Route 66. Like, and of course, the big question, here they are, they're 22 years old, right? And they're absolutely in the best health of their entire lives, for goodness sake. I mean, Walt was one of the top offensive linemen, played in a Rose Bowl, you know, Henry, like a running back for Berkeley. Like, I mean, they're in fantastic, they're young, they're, you got great shape, like, and they've got this like road trip, this epic road trip that they're going to take off and go on to go all the way across the country. How far will they get before they get into trouble? This is really kind of fun for me to say, Arizona. Almost the entire book takes place right here in Arizona. Like that's a.
I think like he's basing it on his own epic motorcycle ride. I told them before you came out about your second book when, you know, your publisher wasn't touring you, you hopped on. I think you actually wrote and asked me if it was okay. I'm going, really? He's even asking?
Yeah, the one I should have asked was my wife is what I should have done. Like, that's where.
Very true. But you did actually. We're up on your motorcycle. We were a little bookstore, smaller than this one by a lot, over across from Molly's on Main Street. I don't know if any of you, because this is our third bookstore and we've been here since 1999, but. This was, where actually, when did the second one, now that I think about it? This has gone on
06.
So
06.
Okay, so it wouldn't have. You would have always been in this bookstore then.
Yeah, I think so.
I tend to think everything's gone on as long as the bookstore has, but clearly not. Right. So are you writing anything else? Because, you know, I know that, you know how much Craig enjoys, like, slipping Sherlock Holmes into the Walt stories and other literary figures. You know, from time to time, I think I remember you're toying around with writing something else.
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, there are other pieces that I'm already working on. As a matter of fact, I'm working on another novella right now. Like, it's called Tooth and Claw. And it's about Walt's experiences in Alaska when he leaves Johnston Atoll, like it, and goes up to Alaska and does security work on one of the big oil rigs on the North Slope, like it. And so, of course, with a title like Tooth and Claw, you can make your own judgments about what it's going to be about, like that. But I remember I do fishing. I fish up there a lot every summer. Like, I try and get up there and go fishing, like that. And I remember there was one guy
Inuit, and I was talking to him, like, and he goes, yes, yeah. He says, my grandson just got a job as a spotter for one of the geologic teams, like, and I said, well, what do the spotters do? Like, and he says, they keep you from getting eaten by polar bears is what they do. And what they do is when they fly in to do these core samples and stuff, they fly in and they land, and the first thing they do is run out there and start assembling this, like, aluminum little, like, gunrail tower. And they set the thing up, like, and then the spotter goes up there with a, you know, 416 Rigby with a scope, and it's going to track with a mobile seat so that they can turn in all directions. And that's what they do, because they're out there on that far ice. Like, and the problem is some of these polar bears have come in off that ice and haven't eaten in, like, you know, 4-5 months. And they aren't afraid of human beings. They aren't afraid of them at all. They just look at them as seal that can't swim really well, you know? And so it makes for, like, you know, an exciting, you know, proposition for that. Like, so that one's coming up. We're also almost, we're about to the point where we have enough short stories that I can do another anthology of short stories. Like, so that'll be coming out too. Like, that I'll have another short story this year. Like, and then I think probably we'll be about due. For another anthology.
Are you still doing the Christmas stories?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, those will be all the ones encompassed in the anthology. Like that. And then, of course, you know, I've got a period Western that I'm working on and a psychological thriller that I'm working on. Like, I've got this one mystery that takes place, you know, in World War II during the fall of Berlin, like at a 1940, you know, late 1944, like that early 1945. So, yeah, I've got, you know, a couple of different things that I'm working on that are fun like that. It's just a question of being able to have enough time, like, and give them the quality time that I need to work on them.
So if you weren't out cutting wood and trying to show off, you know, carve off your foot, you could actually write more, right?
You know, you talk to my wife how she feels about that firewood come January and February, like, and we can have this conversation, Barbara, like, but other than that, I'm afraid, you know.
You keep trying to get me to come and visit you in January. This time I will get to do it. Last time I was there, they have a really lovely guest house, and the bedroom is up on the second floor, and there's sort of a suggestion of a stairway, but the bathroom is down on the lower floor, and when it's dark, you really wonder if you're about to step off into, you know, into nowhere. So can I have a nightlight if I come?
Absolutely. I'll get you one of those little headlights so you can just, you know, wear like that when you're here.
Well, it'll be great fun. Actually, Craig has a very interesting writing, so why don't we describe where you go to write? Because, you know, that's fascinating.
It's, she was mentioning the guest house, like, and what happened was is that I really wanted a writing cabin, and Judy really wanted a guest cabin. And so we did, you know, what married people do, and we compromised, and so now we have a guest cabin. not quite sure how that worked like that, but somehow I lost. I'm not quite sure like that, but anyway, like that, what I do is I work in the house, like that. I've got a loft that's up above the garage, like it, and so you have to go up the spiral staircase, you know, and up there, you know, and kind of, it's kind of like my fortress of solitude is what it is, like, at all kind of tucked
away. It's almost death defying to go up and down. I know. Is there a piano up there?
Yes, there is.
That's what I, how did you get the piano
that
up
was
there?
A challenge, like, at a cargo net, a come along, like, at an eye bolt that went through one of the main beams, because I built the whole place myself, like, at, I had one of those dads that thought you were slave labor, you know, until you escaped, like, that. So I learned how to do basic construction, plumbing, electricity, all that. And I also had an uncle who was, had a construction company, so we always, you know, worked for him, like, in the summertime whenever he needed us, like, and so I learned how to do all that stuff. And I remember my dad saying, okay, you might have enough money someday to hire somebody to do this stuff, but if you don't, like that, you'll know how to do it. But if you do, well, then at least you'll know what you're paying for when you do, like it. And so, and he was right, of course, he was right about most things, like, and I'm always reminded of that great quote by Mark Twain, where he says, you know, I couldn't believe what an idiot my father was when I was young. And he said, I couldn't believe how smart he got by the time I got to be 30, you know, like, and so, you know, but they do, it's kind of like Walt's grandfather teaching him, like, you know, a lot of lessons that, you know, maybe, you know, Walt didn't know that he needed at that point in time, like that, but that he kind of did. And some of them have kind of, like, saved his life as time has gone by.
Why don't you take questions?
Absolutely. I'll be happy to. Anybody got any questions you want to ask? Yes, ma'am. It's Evoetse Heomese, like that is what it is. And what it is, it's a literal translation of the wandering without, is what it is. Like the wandering without?
No,
Oh, the pronunciation, Evoetse, Heomese. You know, I've got a working knowledge, like, of Cheyenne, like that, but that was, like, a term that I had never heard before. Like, and so whenever I was talking to Charles White Man, like, he gave me the total translation of it, like that, and I thought, ooh, that's just about scary. So, anybody else? Like, you guys are quiet. Yes, ma'am. No, it wasn't in Cold Dish. Like it was in, yeah, and it was like he's talking about basically how, you know, if things had turned out all right, it wasn't Dark Horse, it must have been later on. Which one was it? Because it was, because I know that when the TV show was getting made, the book that I handed out to all the cast members was Hell is Empty. And I gave all of them that one. And so I think it's either that one or possibly the next book, like that Walt talks about if this was a movie, you know, and things had turned out, you know, the way they should, you know, she would have been played, you know, she would have been played by Ava Gardner and I would have been played by Robert Taylor. So yeah, I did throw that in there just to kind of monkey with Robert. So the other thing was, is like, actually, Robert Taylor actually had a cabin up above Buffalo, Wyoming. He was from, I think, over near Lincoln, Nebraska, from out on the plains, you know. And when he was growing up, like, his family would always vacation and go fishing in the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming. They would go to the nearest mountain range, which was the Bighorns. And so he always wanted a cabin in the Bighorn Mountains. Like, and so if you look up, I think it's in Look or Life magazine, there's actually a photo spread of the older Robert Taylor, you know, and, you know, it's him in his cabin with his family and his kids and all that. It's really kind of cool, I have to admit. And one of the little novellas I've got in the back of my head is that Robert Taylor comes and rides in the rodeo parade in Durant, like that, and Walt and Henry have to be his bodyguards, like, you know, as teenagers, like that. And so that's somewhere off in the future, too. Like, we'll see what happens. Somebody else had their hand up. Yes, sir.
Do you ever discuss book ideas with C.J. Box?
No, not really. Like that. I mean, it's interesting because everybody always asks, you know, do you Wyoming authors get together? And it's like, no. I mean, what, you know, we live like there's like 7 hours, you know, distance, you know, from the north end to the south end of Wyoming. I live all the way up in the northern end of Wyoming near Montana, and he lives down in the southern end down towards Denver and Colorado, like that. And so, no. But I'm always, whenever I'm talking to like authors from California or something, and then, you know, they'll say, oh, well, we all get together at the coffee shop and talk about our books. Do you Wyoming authors do that? And I'm like, no. Where would we do it? At a road stop or, you know, a rest area or what? Like that, but, you know. So, anybody else? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question.
Uh-oh.
I want to share something that's too modest to share with you guys.
Hold on. Nobody's going
to be able to hear you. By the way, I enjoy your jewelry. It looks just like the cover of my book. Look
Thank
at that.
Thank you.
Good job.
I'm on the executive board of the Will Rogers Medallion Awards, and in a few weeks, Craig's going to be joining us in Fort Worth, and he's going to be presented with our Golden Lariat Award, which is a really wonderful award, and I'm thrilled that I got to be on the committee to help secure this for him, because not only because of his extraordinary writing, because we felt like on this committee that he exemplifies what Will Rogers and his writing did, and so we're going to enjoy giving him that award in a few weeks.
Thank you.
So I thought you all would want to give him some applause.
I love it.
I love having my name attached to Will Rogers. I got to admit, like the other thing I think, you know, it's, you know, really a standout aspect of his writing and his character and everything was the even-handed, you know, friendliness and humor that his writing kind of displayed, like that. I love the humor. And for me, the humor is always going to be a major part of what it is that I do. There, you know, a lot of writers write, you know, about the area where I come from, and they have no humor in their books at all. And I'm like, or they don't have any natives in their books at all. Like, and I'm like, you know, where are you living? Like that, because it's not where I live. Like that, it's kind of an important aspect, I think, the humor, because that hardship, like, how do you get through the end of a hard day? Is, you know, with that sense of humor. It's better than a bulletproof vest in many ways. Like it. And so for me, he's always going to exemplify some of the most wonderful aspects of Western writing, I have to admit. Yes?
What
You know, it's question is like with the murdered missing indigenous women's situation like that in Indian country, like actually it has, like, you know, because a lot of the visibility was the problem. A lot of people, you know, these women were being abducted or, you know, just disappeared, and nobody cared because nobody knew about it. And now it seems as though it's become much more of a stronger cause and people are aware. I am kind of also proud of the fact that, like, you know, we also, after Longmire days, we always have charities that we give the money to, and we always give some to a national charity and then some to a local charity. And I believe we gave about $40,000 to the Murdered Missing Indigenous Women's Resource Center up in Lame Deer, Montana, after Longmire days. Like, and so I would like to think that, you know, we've helped in some small way, like, to make sure that that is a much more, you know, visible problem in Indian country.
I was just looking up when you were talking about Will Rogers. I was thinking about Zane Grey, who was another great Western writer. Have any of you been up to Payson, where there's an actual Zane Grey cabin and a hole? And there's a wonderful little ranger guy that will take you through it and show you. I mean, we've never done that, but we should go up there. But it's really a nifty thing if you like Western writing to go up there. And they have No, I understand. It is in the same place, and they, right? Oh well, how wonderful! But they also, if I remember right, have a little bookstore, and you know, there's some cool things that you can get up there. But I've always thought that, you know, remember when westerns were like all over television? God, it was Maverick and Gunsmoke and Bonanza.
Oh gosh, yeah.
You know, I mean, there was a whole period of time in the '50s when you could almost.
Oh, yeah. There were like 153 westerns on television at one point in time.
There was a Route 66 western. Do you remember what it was called? The guy, I can't remember, but that was his beat, was Route 66. It was another kind of western. And then for some reason, it all sort of fell out of fashion. And, you know, other kind of things came in.
Well, everybody's always quick to say, oh, well, the Western is dead. Every time a Western comes out, it's like, okay, that's it. That's the penultimate Western. That's it. They're done. There's no more Westerns, you know. And then, of course, there's another Western, you know. So it's kind of interesting to see how quick they're wanting to put the casket, you know, and close it and nail it shut like that. But
that's not the one I'm laughing about is
like whenever I'm doing talks at the Western Writers of America, you know, and they're always asking me, like, well, the success that you've had, you know, and, you know, with the TV show and all these things, like, what kind of advice, you know, would you give? Like, and I'm always looking out at the audience and going, hey, folks, don't rewrite Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey like that. Because you know what? Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey were pretty good at writing Louis L'Amour and Zane Grey like that. And so, you know, do something different. Go in a different direction. I was doing an interview this morning like that, and they were talking about the success of the TV show like that. And they said, well, what do you think some of the things that made it happen? And I was like, well, the first thing is like it was one of the, you know, recently, it was one of the first, you know, contemporary Westerns that's been done in decades. You know, we were one of the first ones. Like, and now you're seeing all of these contemporary Westerns that are coming back out. Like, and so sometimes all it takes is just a slight little bit of tweaking, you know, especially with something as powerful as that genre of Western. Like, you know, if you can combine the Westerns also, you know, with a mystery kind of aspect to it, too, that makes it even that much more fun.
So this is really scary. I just looked up Route 66, the TV program, because I remembered it. And it was on. Do you want to know who some of the people in the cast were? Lightweights. Robert Redford. William Shatner.
Well, now that's the original Route 66 you're talking about with Martin Milner and George Maharis. Like that, you know, yeah.
I know. So, I mean, you know. That's what a lot of people got their start in Westerns.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Was it Little Joe and Bonanza?
Do you know that was two of the individuals that they were going to have that originally got the two they were looking at originally for the roles of those two characters were Burt Reynolds and Robert Redford. That's what they were going to make that TV show with those two individuals. Like, but then they got other jobs. Like, and I think Burt Reynolds got a job in Gunsmoke. Like, and so that took him out of the running. Like, and then Robert Redford had another thing where he got cast in something else. And so that's when Martin Milner and George Maharis got those roles.
He probably paired up with, you know, Paul Newman first.
Yeah, I didn't really care. I just wanted the car, you know, one of those C2 Corvettes, you know. That was a nice looking car.
Robert Redford's still chugging along. You know, he and George R.R. Martin are producing the Tony Hillerman series. And I think the new one is maybe, I can't remember if it was already, right. Was it on this summer? Was it? I'm trying to remember. Thank you.
Okay, I give Ann Hillerman a hard time all the time because I'm like, yeah, thank you for that star of yours that was in our show.
You're welcome. Because Zahn McLaren, like that, who played the police chief, like that, in Longmire, actually plays a role. He's a fantastic guy. It could not happen. I mean, to see his star just, you know, shoot off, like that, is just an amazing thing, because he's one of the sweetest, nicest, you know, good-hearted individuals you could ever possibly want to meet. Just a great guy.
Anybody have a final question? Whoa, way over there.
Uh-huh. 24 today, because Judy and I are here. We have a thing where we just go over and hang a new number on the sign.
You know, actually, it's pretty great. I mean, in all actuality, I mean, you know, whenever I come down here like that, I mean, there's so much going on. You know, I was just at Good Morning Arizona, and I'm sitting there, you know, watching, you know, because you're in the green room, you know, they've got the show on and everything. And I was just watching all the stuff that's going on, for goodness sake, like in this town, like that. And I thought to myself, I couldn't live here because there's too much going on. I'd want to go do things, I want to see, all that kind of stuff, like it. And so it's kind of nice to be in the UCLA area. You cross Claremont, Leiter, and Arvada. And if you string all those towns together, you have about 230 people again, and so there really isn't a whole lot going on, you know, in many ways. But it's really kind of nice like that, because that focus for the writing is there. It's very easy for me to just, you know, focus on the writing. Okay, and you know, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because we went up from 25 to 26 just last year, and it caused a major ruckus because nobody had a baby. And nobody moved in. And so everybody was very curious as to where that 26th person came from. Like, and I've got a theory on that. My theory is that it's like, you know, it's for the federal government. You know, if you get enough towns that have, you know, like an increase in population, that they can get more money from the federal government. And I think they thought, you know what, after 40 years, we're going to give UCross one more. That's what we're going to do. Like, and so I think that's what it all boils down to. Like,
that's because you wrote this book, looking at the federal government. I don't know. I've got to love it. So are we done in terms of questions? Whoop, one more.
You know, amazingly enough, that was asked to me about a week ago in one of the interviews that I was doing. Like, and I had an epiphany is what I had, because the first thing I said was calm down. You know, what I would say to myself when I was young was like, just calm down. It's all going to work out. It's all going to be all right. And then I thought about it, and I thought, you know, that insecurity and that energy, that frenetic energy that you've got when you're young, you know, I think that's a good thing. It's one of the things that drives you on to do the things that you need to do, like write a book, like write 20 books or something like that. So I don't know. I would be very, very careful to if I would give myself any advice at all. I don't think I would give myself any advice at all. My life turned out just pretty much exactly the way I hoped it would. The only thing I would say is go get them, Tiger. Keep going. You know, that'd be about all I'd have to say. But get some steel-toed logging boots. That's what I would say. Say to myself. Okay.
All righty. Well, this is the moment when we like to give you guys something, and thank you for coming. And today we have two things. We have an advanced reading copy of a book by Taylor Moore called Ricochet, and he has not Vietnam, but a CIA counter-espionage guy who's come back to Texas, to the Panhandle, and is trying to save his ranch. And, sorry? That's okay. What were you saying? So right. So if you bought a book, you should have a numbered ticket, and that's what we're going to use. Anyway, Taylor was in fact a CIA agent, but he was really more DEA. I guess he was DEA, and they liaised with the CIA. But it's a really interesting view of life in a very hostile. Patrick, where are you? Are you back there? Come and tell us about where Taylor Moore's book is set with him, because Patrick actually knows way more about this than I do, because he talked to Graham about it.
Yeah, it's in the, do you guys know the Llano Estacado, the Staked Plains part of Texas? A lot of nods. Nobody? Okay. All right. It's just a very forbidding, sorry? A little louder. Okay, yeah. It's this just very forbidding landscape in Texas, the Staked Plains, and of course it's the Comanches, you know, land. And are you familiar with that region,
yeah.
Craig? Yeah, Yeah, and what else can I tell you?
Well, it's just a part of the West that I didn't know anything much about. Thank goodness Patrick was on the Zoom with me, so, you know, he was able to find that out. But, you know, there are huge tracts of the West that are really still, to this day, not familiar to many of us. And so I really like the territory of the book. So, PK, numbers? 74? Wow, 74 of you here bought a book today. Thank you very much. That's outstanding. So, Craig, pick a number between try not to look at the man with the glasses.
13. Who's unlucky?
It might be a person who didn't come to the, because you have to be here to win. Is there a 13 in the pickup pile up there? Probably is. Yep. All right, so you have to pick another number. Aha, we have a winner. All right, thank you. I'll get your book to you. And now we have something really nice, and I'll let Craig tell you about it because he brought it up the aisle, wrong side up. Here we go. So it's all, well, you tell them.
It's a poster of all of the book covers. Look at all the way back from the cold dish all the way up to the Longmire defense.
And so, signed by Craig.
You know.
Right, so you get to pick another number that's not 13 or 31.
Okay, number one.
Oh, look at you. Well, that'll be easy.
You didn't walk very far or anything here, for goodness sake. My pleasure.
Just for your knowledge, the most common number always picked by authors is 17. So if you want to maneuver, yeah, it really is. I have no idea why, but it's 17 more often than you can imagine. But I can't remember anybody ever picking number one before, so good for you. That's very nice. Anyway, thank you all very much for coming. Let's give Craig a round of applause. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.